A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 71 of the Intercooler podcast. And this one is going to be a little bit different. We're sort of introducing a new format, Andrew, because we often talk about places and companies and cars and engines. But actually, I think the most interesting subject matter in our little world is the people.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I don't know if you listen to, there's a great thing on Radio 4, which just shows how old I am, but called Great Lives. And it's, you know, and it's Matthew Paris, who is a fantastic journalist. And he just every week interviews someone about someone. And it could be anybody from, I don't know, Marilyn Monroe to Genghis Khan. I think the only qualification is, and we're going to fail in this very first regard, is the only qualification to get on Great Lives is you've got to be dead. and our subject this week most certainly isn't. But that's fine. We're not trying to copy them. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it would just be nice. We're not going to do this every week, but just to, I mean, there are so many extraordinary figures in this business. And again, this week is going to be a driver. But it's not always going to be a driver. It could be, you know, the head of a car company or whatever. So we'll give it a go and see what people think.
Yeah, let us know what you think. Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Great Lives. Colin Chapman was the subject of a Great Lives a little while ago.
He was.
Someone went on there. And I listened to the start of it, and Matthew Paris, you know, he has his view, that's fair enough, but he made it immediately clear that he had a very dim view of Formula One. And from the moment that intro onwards, I just thought, actually, I can't listen to this. The bloke's so uninterested.
I don't think he knows anything about Formula One.
I think he actively disliked it as well, though, which I just found slightly off-putting.
I did listen to one. Sterling did one. He was the interviewee, and his subject was Fangio.
Yeah.
And he only recorded that about 7 or 8 years ago. And the thing is, it's all on BBC Sounds. So if you just go on BBC Sounds and you go on the Great Lives thing and you just scroll down, you'll find Sterling Moss on Juan Manuel Fangio. And that's actually really interesting because it's, you know, it's very interesting just to hear, you know, someone as, and sadly I'm going to fail again here, but someone as amazing as Sterling talking about someone where I'm afraid today just going to get kind of get, well, you and me doing it. So never mind.
Well, we've set ourselves up for a fall, haven't we? Well, okay, so let's get stuck into it then. We are talking about, and I didn't realise this was his name until this morning, we're talking about Sir John Young Stewart.
J-Y-S.
J-Y-S. I didn't realise J was actually for John, because we all know him as Jackie Stewart, Sir Jackie Stewart. He is actually the last surviving Formula One world champion from the 60s.
Yes.
Yeah. 82 years old. A triple F1 champion. Scottish. He competed for 9 seasons and won 3 of them. Twice runner-up. 99 starts. And that's an interesting number that we'll come to a bit later on.
27 wins.
Exceptional record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even that doesn't actually give a good indication of how good he was for reasons I'll explain in a minute.
Yeah, well, quite. Let's go all the way back to the beginning then, just to sort of give us some context. Born 11th of June 1939 in Scotland, a village 15 miles west of Glasgow. The Stewart family were car dealers, successful car dealers. His father was an amateur motorcycle racer, and his brother was a racing driver.
Jimmy was, he was good.
He competed actually started at the 53 British Grand Prix. At
there you go. I was about to say, I can't remember what he did. It was the only Grand Prix he did. It was the whole Jimmy Stewart story is actually quite sad because, this is very much on public record, so we can say it. He did, certainly through his later life, he did have a struggle with addiction, alcohol. But, you know, he could have been really good. I mean, he raced a Works Aston Martin at Le Mans in 1954, DB3S Coupe. Had a huge accident in it. Because not through his fault, the cars were, you know, they had two in there, and they both had huge accidents through aerodynamic instability, and he broke his arm, and then something happened. He was going to be Hawthorne's teammate at Le Mans in 55, which Hawthorne, you know, that's the one that where the terrible accident was, but that's the one Hawthorne went and won it. But a few days before, he was racing at the Nürburgring and had another accident and just said, that's enough, and walked away from it. But
at the Nürburgring, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Very poignant. So back to Jackie, and one of the sort of defining features of his young life was undiagnosed dyslexia. The condition just wasn't understood then, and so...
He was in his 40s before it was diagnosed.
Yeah. Yeah, and so as a young'un, his teachers, his friends, perhaps even his family, just thought he was a bit thick, which is a very sad thing. I've got a brother with dyslexia, and he's very bright, very sharp. He's in a very senior management role within the NHS, and he's very good at what he does. But I remember him struggling at school. And even then, 20-odd years ago, 25 years ago, it was totally misunderstood, and people thought maybe he wasn't particularly intelligent, which is totally unfair.
What I find so bemusing about this is the disconnect. Because if you meet Jackie, as I've done a few times, and everyone's seen him being interviewed, you know, the last words that would ever come into the brain of anyone watching Jackie Stewart talking was a bit thick. I mean, the man is, and he's 82 now, and he's as sharp today as he ever was. You know, the man is clearly got an enormous intellect. His ability to communicate, to structure things in his head. I mean, you know, and it just surprises me that when presented with someone as intelligent as that, who for some reason struggles with written work, that your conclusion is not there's something going on here, but oh, we must be a bit thick.
It's extraordinary. Totally different time.
But it is absolutely. And I think it was only when his son Mark was diagnosed with it when he was a kid that Jackie went, oh, and then realised it was an inheritable condition. And yeah, there you go.
And so I suppose the main point is that it meant that he was never destined for a life of academia or a professional job.
No.
And so he left school at 15, actually, and began working in his father's garage as an apprentice mechanic. And so he was involved with cars. And, I mean, it's amazing, really, isn't it? What a twist that was. It was his dyslexia that got him involved with cars. But even before he started tinkering with cars, and well before he started racing them, he was an exceptionally talented skeet shooter, clay pigeon shooter. He was
national champion. He tried for the Olympics.
He very nearly made the Olympic team.
Which 1960.
Good knowledge. Yeah, the 1960 Summer Olympics. It's so frustrating, isn't it, that someone can have two very disparate, exceptional talents.
How disparate are they really? I mean, you know, motor racing, skeet shooting, it's all about hand-eye coordination, isn't it?
So there's something there, isn't there?
It's. I mean, they cannot be unrelated. I mean, I don't know of any other racing drivers who are crack shots. But then again, I know nothing about shooting, so maybe there are. But I just don't believe that's a coincidence.
Okay, it has, fair enough.
Just that ability to coordinate in the most, you know, and it's all about reactions, isn't it? It's all about speed and accuracy. and all the things that you needed, well, particularly in his day, to stay alive in a racing car.
I've pulled out a couple of extracts from his autobiography. And it was in the very early 60s that he started driving, racing. And there's one anecdote here that stood out. He'd been doing a little bit of racing, and to decide if he was ready to become a professional driver, he tested a Jaguar E-Type at Alton Park, matching Roy Salvadori's times in a similar car the year before. So not quite like for like, but there was that little sign of promise, that sign of potential. And it was that sort of performance that helped him get noticed, notably by one Ken Tyrrell, who yes. was running the Formula Junior team for the Cooper Car Company. It's interesting, isn't it, that relationship would go on and sort of flourish.
Yeah, Formula Junior is kind of what Formula 3 is today. In fact, it became Formula 3. And he did really well. And what I've always admired about Jackie is people saw the talent. I think the talent was so obvious. People just realised that this bloke was the real deal. And they kept on offering him Formula 1 drives. And he kept on going, no, I'm not ready. And he turned down some really, you know, really decent drives at the top level, preferring to stay in Formula 3 and Formula 2 and really learn his trade. Before, I think he did one non-championship race in 1964. He did it in South Africa, the Rand Grand Prix. But really, his Formula 1 career started in 1965, when he would have been 25. So, you know, quite old to be starting out. But, you know, he'd had this other career with his shooting, and he'd worked his way up. And my goodness, when he started, he was ready to go, wasn't he?
Wasn't he? Yeah. So that's right. His first F1 season was 1965 in a BRM. And he came third at only his second race, which was the Monaco GP. And later on in the year, he won the Italian GP at Monza and finished third in the standings.
Yeah. So he beat Graham Hill, who was his teammate, who was already a world champion and had been racing in Formula One, I think. Graham did his first race in 1958. So Graham Hill was in his eighth season in Formula One. Jackie Stewart was in his eighth race. And he beat him in the same car.
Yeah.
At Monza.
Yeah.
Gives you an idea, really, doesn't it?
And so just imagine someone bursting onto the scene like that. Yeah, that's pretty spectacular, isn't it? And so clearly the talent was there.
Yeah.
The following year he went and won the Monaco GP. But, I mean, the season started well, but actually he had two frustrating seasons in 66 and 67. Uncompetitive and unreliable.
This is what I was going to talk about with the fact that his 27 out of 99 doesn't give a good actual account. Because effectively he lost two seasons to this. BRM always did mad things with their cars. I mean, I think people remember the V16 BRM, the most powerful Formula One car of its era in the early 1950s, but also far and away the most unreliable. Sterling called it the worst car he'd ever driven. Well, they did something no less mad in the mid 60s. So in 1966, when the Formula One went from being a 1.5 litre formula to a 3 litre formula, and BRM had an extremely successful 8 cylinder 1.5 litre engine, they just thought, well, we'll just stick two of them together. So they made, and they shared pistons and conrods and everything. So they turned a 1.5 litre V8 into a 3 litre H16. I think it was like they lay on top of each other, and through some convoluted mechanism shared a common crank. But it was essentially two engines. And surprise, surprise, it was A, quite heavy, and B, not very reliable. So, you know, it did win. That engine won one race, but it was actually in the back of a Lotus. Jim Clark won at Spa, I think. Maybe wrong. Spa in the 60s. I can't remember. 66, I guess. So Jackie lost two seasons. When you remember 27 out of 99, you think, oh, well, you know, Jim Clark, who did 25 out of 75, so a much better hit rate. Jim Clark had some pretty unreliable cars because he was racing for Lotus, but, I mean, he didn't lose two seasons. And Jackie did.
Yeah, that's a lot of ground to lose, isn't it, in terms of win ratio?
Yeah.
And so, in 66, at Spa, he had a big old crash. And as we know, Jackie Stewart became a real champion for improving safety in Grand Prix racing. I'm sure we'll come on to that a little bit later. But it's worth talking now about that very formative experience. Still a relatively inexperienced racing driver at a fearsome circuit like Spa, the old Spa. And he had a horrible crash. So there's an account of it here that I'll just sort of scan through now. The race started dry, but midway through the first lap, the heavens opened and left the road resembling polished glass, and a number of cars aquaplaned in various directions. Some were lucky and remained on track, others less so. And there's a quote from Graham Hill in the Times. One minute it was dry, the next it was covered in driving rain. One car started to spin, and the others as they tried to avoid it. Then cars started hitting each other, with four eventually involved going in all directions. So just total chaos, pandemonium. We've seen that at Spa multiple times, even recently, haven't we? When the rain comes down, the cars just fly off. And so Jackie Stewart himself told Alan Henry in The Guardian, "We just ran into a wall of water in the way it can only rain in southern Belgium." That was actually 3 decades later, he told Alan Henry that. And it was at 170 miles an hour, his BRM aquaplaned as he approached the Master Kink. Not really where you want that to happen, is it? And there's this quote from him. "First I hit a telegraph pole, and then a woodcutter's cottage, and I finished up in the outside basement of a farm building. The car ended up shaped like a banana, and I was still trapped inside it. The fuel tank had totally ruptured inwardly, and the monocoque literally filled up with fuel. It was sloshing around in the cockpit. The instrument panel
was lying in a bath of petrol.
The instrument panel was smashed, ripped off, and found 200 metres from the car, but the electric fuel pump was still working away. The steering wheel wouldn't come off, and I couldn't get out." Doesn't really bear thinking about, actually. Thankfully, a couple of the other guys, including Hill, slid off in the same place, but without having such serious crashes, and they were able to go and help him. The issue here, and I think what really angered Jackie Stewart, was that there was no provision for an accident. There was no sort of safety car, as it were. There were no paramedics, no emergency crews.
I think for a moment that this is the same circuit where 6 years earlier, two British drivers, Alan Stacey and Chris Bristow, had lost their lives. Sterling had a normal accident. And then there was one of the Taylors. Was it Mike Taylor? He went off at Stavelo, and he went so far off the circuit, and the facilities were so poor, it took them 3/4 of an hour just to find him, to realise he wasn't on the circuit anymore, and to get to where he was. And he had, you know, he had career-ending injuries. And yet, 6 years later, when Jackie goes off, it appears they'd learned nothing. And that, I think, is, you know, shocking. Absolutely shocking.
It tells you how little regard there was for driver safety at the time, even spectator safety. It's unbelievable that that was allowed to happen. And really, you see why it was necessary that someone took a hold of all this and said, this is not good enough. We need to do better. So it took 25 minutes to get Clark out of the car. And even then the ordeal was not over. He was loaded into an old ambulance, which took him to what passed for a medical centre, and he was left there on a canvas stretcher. "There were no doctors," says Stewart. "I was left on a stretcher, on the floor, surrounded by cigarette ends. It was filthy." And it goes on. He was loaded into another ambulance on the way to Liège with a police escort, but the ambulance lost the police escort. The ambulance driver got lost, didn't know where he was going. Just imagine, you've had an enormous crash, you've knocked yourself about, and this is the response that you get from the sport that you're racing in. You can see why he was so angered by this.
I think even there, in that anger, I think he was being way ahead of his time, because I think that there were lots of drivers who just, you know, we can't judge it accurately from where we're sitting now, because we have just got too much stuff has happened between now and then, and we think, gosh, you know, today, you know, someone would have been there within 20 seconds and he'd be out the car and you would have had world-class middle. And because none of that existed back then, the level of expectations were just so low. And I've spoken to a few drivers about this, And they said just at the time, they said they just wanted to be racing drivers. And they tried not to think of the risks. When they did, they thought it would only happen to other people. And all that just kind of went with the territory. And I think that where Jackie was so far ahead of his time was to say, well, it does go with the territory, but it shouldn't. And this isn't acceptable. And other drivers were, you know, he had by no means did he have everybody on his side. You know, I think a lot of people accused him of being, you know, a coward, and, you know, this is motor racing and it's a gladiatorial sport. And also, and I do buy into this a bit, everybody who gets in the car knows the risks that they are taking. And if you don't like that, you don't have to get into the car. And I've always felt that to an extent. But at the same time, clearly, you want the sport to be as safe as the sport can be, while maintaining its magic and its mystique. And even Jackie today will say that the sport's gone too far, and that actually, in its efforts to make motor racing safe, it has taken away a lot of magic. Because, for instance, you know, we're replacing gravel traps with tarmac runoff areas, so there are no consequences to flying off the circuit. So I'm sure we'll get onto this in a minute. But he was just, you know, he was just ahead of his time there. And I admire him for it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, motor racing was dangerous then, but the disregard is just pathetic, actually, looking back now. There wasn't a proper medical provision. There weren't doctors at the circuit. You know, it's unthinkable now.
And you can see why. Where people had died for so long. I mean, this was the circuit where racing started, I think, in 1922. No, guys like Dick Seaman had died there. Archie Scott Brown had died there. And, you know, in both those cases, indeed, one of the contributing factors was that they just weren't attended to. I mean, both Dick Seaman and Archie Scott Brown, okay, they'd been burned and they'd been injured, but they were absolutely alive when they came out of the car. Both of them lived for, you know, what I mean, morbid about this, for a while. And I think in both cases, had there been, even in that era, the absolute best medical attention that was available, certainly their chance of living would have been hugely improved.
Yeah, you can see why somebody had to speak out about all this. And a few years later, he himself said, "If I have any legacy to leave the sport, I hope it will be seen to be an area of safety, because when I arrived in Grand Prix racing, so-called precautions and safety measures were diabolical." Damning. Okay, so you can see why that was such a formative experience for him. And he had those two frustrating years. But then come 1968, things started to turn around. Matra, yeah. with
and,
his old
and
friend.
And a DFV.
And a DFV and his old friend Ken Tyrrell. And he won races again. And it was the following season, in 1969, that he won his first title. So all that potential, all that talent fulfilled, he's a Formula One world champion. And that was just the first of three. So, I mean, which races or which seasons do you think we should particularly talk about?
Okay, so probably first. So, I mean, okay, which race? Clearly, Nürburgring 1968. I mean, I think that most people, including Jackie, would say that was his day of days. So, this was the Nürburgring, and it wasn't the Nürburgring as it is today. It was, you know, there was less runoff. The track went up and down a lot more. I mean, you know, you can go
no
and look at footage of it. Obviously, no barriers. It was absolutely bloody lethal on a really good day. And this was not a really good day. The weather was absolutely filthy. It wasn't enough that it was raining. It was bucketing down. And it wasn't enough for it to be bucketing down. It was also thick, thick fog. And he was in the Matra with the DFV in the back. He qualified on the third row. But when the race started, there were two races. There was one race for Jackie Stewart and another race for literally everybody else in the race. He got from the third row. I think at the end of the first lap, he led the field by 8 seconds. At the end of the second lap, he led the field by 34 seconds. And then he just disappeared. Now, okay, it's a long lap. I think those races were maybe only like 14 laps long. And he did have good tyres on the car. But even so, when he won that race, he won the race, he got out the car, said hello to a few people, shook a few hands, and was standing in the grandstand with some mates and an umbrella by the time Graham Hill came over the line to finish second. He finished over 4 minutes ahead of anybody else in that race. You know, a race full of, you know, world champions, some of the finest wet weather drivers of all time, you know, Jackie Ickx among them. They're all there. And yeah, 4 minutes. He dropped them by 4 minutes. And I just think that's extraordinary. I mean, I can't imagine there has ever been a greater winning margin than that. There may have been in some freak second circumstances, but in a race where, I mean, nobody actually, you know, I think because it was so horrible, people were so careful, there weren't any big accidents. It's not like, you know, the race got stopped and he somehow managed to, you know, get a bit lucky and get himself an artificial lead. That was just on merit. 4 minutes. I mean, it's extraordinary. It is absolutely extraordinary.
What a talent.
And there was, right at the other end of his career, 1973, at Monza, he only came fourth in this race, but he had a down on power engine, and I think he'd started fourth or fifth or something, and he wasn't having a great weekend, and then the car went really, really sideways on him, and he realised he had a puncture, and he managed to get back to the pits, and he lost like a minute and a half because, you know, they didn't change tyres back then the way that you didn't expect to change tyres back then. So, you know, the whole thing was a bit Heath Robinson and took a long time. And he came back into the race and he was 19th with a lot of the race already done. And the way he fought back. And the other thing was, I think he'd already won the championship. Okay. He knew he was going to retire. This was right at the end of the 73 season. He didn't have to do it. That's the thing. But he did anyway, and he just battled his way back through the field. Ken Terrell always said that it wasn't the Nürburgring, because Ken Terrell said at the Nürburgring, yeah, Jackie was amazing, but they had a really good car and it had really good tyres. But Ken Terrell said that actually at Monza, the competition was much, much hotter, and Jackie didn't have to do it, but he still did, and he came home fourth. And Ken Terrell said that it was that race at Monza in 73, not the Nürburgring in 68 that was Jackie's greatest race.
Wow, that's great, isn't it? And he, that year, his last win, his last ever F1 win was that year at the Nürburgring. And he's quoted as saying, "Nothing gave me more satisfaction than to win at the Nürburgring, and yet I was always afraid. When I left home for the German Grand Prix, I always used to pause at the end of the driveway and take a long look back. I was never sure I'd come home again." He's often attributed with that phrase that we all know, green hell, isn't he? Do we know that that's true?
Well, I haven't heard that it's not. I don't know that it's true. He may have heard it from somewhere else, but no, I think I've got a... If anybody wants a... I don't know whether you can still get it. I've got a book here called My Greatest Race, and it's got lots of people, Mario Andretti, Jack Brabham, Fangio, Fittipaldi, Graham Hill, then you have lots of people give their greatest race, but... There's a little bit in here about Jackie talking about the Nürburgring. Drivers are often asked what is their favourite circuit. In the majority of cases, they say the Nürburgring is the most satisfying. This is said in most cases while sitting in armchairs in the comfort of their own homes with roaring fires in front of them. But really, I don't believe that too many people would honestly admit that they enjoy driving on the Nürburgring in a Formula One car. I know that whenever I drive there, I get back to the pits and take a big deep breath because, my God, I'm pleased to be home.
Flipping heck. Fair play to him as a triple world champion for being outspoken about that place and the dangers. Yeah. That's brave, isn't it? That's super brave.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I
mention something else, not Formula One? Because I think people, just because Jackie won those three titles, they just think of Jackie as, you know, just a great Formula One driver, which obviously he was. But he did do other stuff.
Can-Am.
You know, for instance, Can-Am. Yeah, so in 1971, he drove a Lola in Can-Am. Now, because he was quite busy doing other stuff, yeah, he only did half the season. There were 10 races, he did 5 of them. And he still came third, okay, behind the two McLarens, okay? He was, in 1971, he was the only person to beat the McLarens, because the McLarens of Peter Revson and Denny Hulme, they were just, because they'd been doing it for so long, and because they were so good, and because McLarens had won everything in Can-Am almost since the start of, in fact, basically since the start of Can-Am, they were regarded as unbeatable. And in that, and this 1971 was the last season before the turbo Porsches came over and just changed the wheels completely. So when the McLarens were at their absolute best, they got beaten twice, both times by Jackie Stewart, who had never raced in Can-Am before, never raced Can-Am cars before. He only did half the season, and he still came third, and he won twice, and he put it on pole a lot of times as well. I mean, it just gives you an idea of the measure of the man. You know, he's used to racing, you know, tiny little cigar tube Formula One cars, and then he goes over there with a big banger Lola with an 8.5 litre V8 in the back of it, and he's still the best of them.
Okay, well, let's finish off his Formula One career, and then we can talk about life after Formula One, because there's plenty to say. So his final race was going to be the US Grand Prix at Watkins Glen in 73. It was going to be his 100th race. What a way to sign off. But his teammate, and actually protege as well, I think, Francois Sever, lost his life in practice. Horrible accident going underneath the guardrail. And because of that, Jackie Stewart just said, no, I'm done. He'd already won the championship.
Yeah.
Didn't need to take that risk, and so he just said,
decided earlier that season that he was going to quit, and he didn't tell anybody. I think he told Ken. Didn't tell anybody else. I don't think he told his family. And then when an event like that happens, you know, obviously the team withdraws the other car. And yeah, and that was it. I'm going to do this now. I wrote something down before I came on. Bear with me a second. I'm going to read a list of names, which will hopefully give you some idea of what he was facing. So, bear with me. Lorenzo Bandino, Pedro Rodriguez, Joe Bonnier, Joe Siffert, Paul Hawkins, Lucien Bianchi, Bruce McLaren, Jochen Rindt, Jim Clark, Mike Spence, Gerhard Mitter, Ludovico Scafiotti, Piers Courage, Ignacio Giunti, Francois Sever, Peter Revson, Roger Williamson, and Joe Schlesser. Every single one of those drivers died racing a car during Jackie's career. Okay?
How many is that?
Hang on. Add in Rolf Stommelen, Ronnie Peterson, Mark Donohue, and Patrick Depailler are people who Jackie also raced against who died in racing cars after Jackie had stopped racing. I mean, it's just... There are over 20 names on that list. Over 20 people who died while racing cars during Jackie Stewart's career. And given that he did... Now, you know, let us say that he did 9 seasons, didn't he? It's over 20 people. So that's 2 and a bit people per season. And given that he did 9 seasons... I mean, actually, his chances of surviving for as long as he did... I mean, it's just... I find myself getting quite emotional about it because I just know that... you know, even if I'd had talent, even if I had money, I just couldn't have done it because I would have thought too much about the odds. But you can see, you know, he must have been. I mean, he's, you know, he knew all those people, but some of them, people like Piers Courage, certainly Jochen Rindt, Joe Bonnier, were really, really good friends of his. So, you know, Jochen Rindt was, you know, pretty much his closest friend in motor racing. It's just.
It's unthinkable that his drive to improve safety at that time was met with any resistance whatsoever, given what was happening couple of times a year. Just staggering.
Absolutely.
Okay. Actually, at the point that he retired, he held the record for most wins in Formula One at 27.
He did. Yep.
He held that record for 14 years until 1987.
Mansell?
No.
Not Mansell?
No.
1987? Prost?
Prost, yeah.
Prost beat him, okay.
Prost took the record. Nigel Mansell took his record for a British driver.
Okay.
And, yeah, so there you go. That context is really helpful, isn't it? Because it demonstrates just what a titan of the sport he was at the time and long after he stopped racing as well. Well, and even now, for him to hold that record for as long as he did. Okay, so he's retired. He's a champion for improving safety in the sport.
He wasn't the only one. You know, I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge Graham Hill's widow, Betty Hill, always got a bit upset when people used to say that Jackie single-handedly raised standards and saved all. I mean, you know, Jackie was, you know, I guess he was the most vocal. He was certainly the most visible. And I would never for a moment want to detract from his contribution. But what I would say is that there were, I know Graham Hill was one, and there were others who kind of realised that Jackie was actually talking sense. But I think it was Jackie who got the ball rolling, and I think he probably, if anybody could be regarded as the prime architect of that, it probably is Jackie.
And he was pushing for actually quite basic things, barriers in front of the pits, full face helmets, mandatory seatbelt usage, just stuff that we absolutely take for granted today, but they did without back then. And actually he led a few boycotts, sitting out some races that he didn't feel comfortable with. Again, enormously brave. And he was really criticised for doing this. He said himself, "I would have been a much more popular world champion if I had always said what people wanted to hear. I might have been dead, but definitely more popular."
Yeah.
Okay. And so, quite apart from being a crack shot, a triple world champion, an advocate for safety in the sport, he also, with his son, ran a team, the Stewart Grand Prix, which was ultimately sold to Ford.
Incredibly successful.
Mm.
Yeah, well, yeah, but well, before Stewart Grand Prix, Paul Stewart Racing, you know, which his son Paul, who's one of the nicest guys in the world, ran with Jackie. But it was Paul Show. I think Jackie was, you know, helped found it and contributed it and everything else. But they became absolutely dominant in Formula 3. And then, as you say, yes, it became Stewart Grand Prix. In
96.
And, you know, they won a race, didn't they?
Yeah, fair play. There's no mean feat.
Do you know what, where and who?
No.
Okay. Silverstone, 99, but it wasn't the British Grand Prix. It was the European Grand Prix. And Johnny Herbert.
Ah, okay.
But there was also an amazing race at Monaco in 97, where Rubens so nearly won it. And he came second because... What happened? I think the weather was horrible but basically he didn't stop and everybody thought he was going to stop and refuel and he didn't. And yeah, there was sort of Jackie in tears and I can remember all that. So yes, he became a successful team owner as well before, as you say, selling it to Ford and then perhaps doing slightly less well.
So that team though became Jaguar, became Red Bull, is that right?
Exactly correct. Exactly correct.
Yeah. Okay, so we should talk about, because you've spent a bit of time with him, so we'll come to that in a moment. But before we move on, we must mention first that he was knighted in 2001. And now one of his big things is Race Against Dementia, the charity
yes.
that he's spearheading. Much of it because his wife, Lady Helen, has dementia and he's seen what that does to a person. And he's set up this charity to help fund research into finding a cure for this horrible disease.
Yeah.
And he's tireless, isn't he? He's 82 and he's still
campaigning. He is an absolutely driven man. And he always has been like that. He's always been like that. He's always, you know, sitting around with his feet up just isn't the Jackie Stewart way. He always wants to be doing stuff. He always wants to be contributing. And yeah, he's on it now as I think he ever was. And, you know, and quite clearly... You know, and he said that, you know, this is the most important battle of his life, to try to change the outcomes for people with this appalling disease. And yeah, it's given him a new focus and, you know, you wouldn't wish on anybody, would you? But, you know, he is, you know, I think Lady Helen was diagnosed in, well, about 5 years ago. So he would have been, what, 77 then? But, you know, in his late 70s, early 80s, he is attacking this new issue with all the energy with which he approached his Formula One career 50 years ago. Extraordinary.
Mm. And someone with his background, his achievements, his platform is well-placed to make a difference here. So fair play to him. Race Against Dementia, just go and search it if you want to find out a little bit more about what he's up to. Okay, but let's talk about your recollections of Sir
well,
Jackie
I mean,
Stewart.
Yes. I mean, it's not as if... I mean, I suspect if Jackie Stewart walked into a room and saw me, he might go, "Do I recognise that bloke?" No, I don't think I do. But, you know, he meets millions of people all the time. But I have... You know, I had a bit of a run-in with him when I was the editor of Motorsport. We did something which he didn't appreciate, and we had to make quite a large donation to the Grand Prix Mechanics Trust. I mean, the thing about Jackie is he's a bloke who Anybody who's worked with Jackie will tell you that he is a person who has very high standards, and he expects very high standards of everybody that he works with. And that suits certain people and perhaps doesn't suit certain other people. But in all other times when I have come across him, he has been charming, highly professional, and always, always, always good to listen to. He gives good value. He's one of these guys that when he talks to a journalist, and so many racing drivers aren't like this, so many racing drivers talk to journalists because they kind of feel that they have to, and they just want to get the interview out of the way as soon as possible, so the answers are quite short, they don't really think about it. You can see that Jackie is sitting there thinking, well, this is going to get written down, this is going to get repeated, so it needs to be good. So he says interesting stuff. He also, by doing that, helps you do your job. And so he makes you look good too. I've only interviewed him a couple of times, but you always come away thinking, that's great. He's also a bloke, although he has, you know, latterly made his career out of being an ambassador particularly for Rolex. I know he's been an ambassador for them, for the Ford Motor Company. He's not one of these guys who's only going to trot out the party line. He does say interesting stuff. He does take stands. He does tell you what he thinks, which is great. What I did do once, and this must have been 10 years ago, a bit more maybe, I did get driven around a track by him in a Noble of some description. I think it was an M400, and it was Silverstone. And I think what had happened, I think that his son Mark is in the film business, or the video business, or whatever. And they'd made, I think, a documentary of his life or something, and it was publicity, and Jackie was there, and they were in the BRDC, and that was fine. But they had the circuit for a bit. And I'm not sure anybody else got to do it, but I'm not quite sure whether I just asked or whatever. But anyway, I got to be driven by Jackie Stewart, who even then would have probably been certainly late 60s, possibly early 70s, in this Noble round track. I'm very lucky. I've been driven round tracks by all sorts of amazing people. But what was so incredible about being driven by Jackie was he just made driving a car really fast look like the easiest thing anybody had ever done. It was just, I can remember that it was so accurate. The car always exited the corner in exactly the same place, to the millimetre. There was no oversteer, there was no understeer. It was just going at a speed I couldn't have imagined being able to make it go. It was so undramatic. He was talking away. And I can remember coming back in, and Jackie got out of the car and went somewhere else, and Mark Stewart came up to me with a grin on his face and said, "What do you think?" And I just told him that I thought, blah, blah. And he turned around to me and he said, "Yeah, but Dad's got an unfair advantage." And I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "No one's told him it's difficult."
It's just never occurred to him that it's a difficult thing to do, has it?
No. And I thought there was a lot. I mean, that's how he drove. He drove like someone who didn't realise that what he was doing was difficult. And if you look at footage of him driving, back in his career, Formula One cars, he was always, he was just the sort of, the ultimate smooth, keep it going forward driver. He wasn't a big sideways merchant or anything like that. He wasn't a dramatic driver. It was all about momentum. It was all about carrying speed. And he taught people how to drive. And he would always talk about, didn't he actually have a basket of air? Well, no, I think he had a basket of balls on the bonnet of the car. And he'd drive around Brands Hatch. I think he did this for Ford and a Ford Granada or something, whatever. But the idea was that he could drive around Brands Hatch at a ridiculous rate, but none of the ping pong balls in this basket would ever come out because he was taking so little out of the car. He was driving it so smoothly. There were so few sudden reactions. They all just stayed there. And that's the way that he raced. And it wasn't like going around the Nürburgring with Jonathan Palmer in a McLaren F1, which was one of the most terrifying things I've ever done, because it was sideways absolutely everywhere. It was like the opposite of that, but in its own way, it was just as impressive, possibly more so.
Mm. Well, you can see why that driving style brought such rewards in a 60s or 70s Grand Prix car, can't you?
Absolutely.
That very smooth, efficient style.
Yeah. And also, I suspect what kept him alive. because, you know, he, I'm not saying that he never binned it, you know, clearly he binned it at Spa, but you, I mean, he wouldn't just go off the circuit. You know, if you drive into a wall of water, then, you know, you're a passenger, aren't you? And that can happen. But, yeah, I think he was probably quite kind to the machineries. I don't think he, well, apart from the X16, I mean, I don't think he had a reputation for blowing things up. I think, you know, he probably, you know, made a lot of his own luck by always being there at the end, not making mistakes, not stressing the machinery. And back then, when those cars were really, really fragile, A, you know, they mechanically broke quite a lot, but they structurally broke quite a lot too. And I suspect that he did an awful lot to keep himself winning and keep himself alive by not pushing these things, you know, harder and faster than they cared to go.
Well, there you go. 45 minutes on Sir John Young, Jackie Stewart.
That passed quite quickly, didn't it?
It went quickly, didn't it? We probably could have done loads good. More. But he's a great candidate for the first in this sort of mini-series. Maybe it needs a name. We'll give that some thought. But
can't
there you go. Let
drives.
Us know what you...
Great drives. No, I don't...
Great drives. Let us know what you think of this sort of new format and who you'd like us to talk about.
Yeah, that'd be a
great
idea.
Drivers. Yeah, they don't have to be... And they don't even have to be people that anyone's ever heard of.
They don't all have to be, you know, guys who have sort of entirely untarnished reputations. You know, we put, you know, put a few, you know, bad boys in there too. That's fine. I'm more than happy to talk about that. But they have to be interesting.
Yeah,
it's not enough that they were just kind of quite quick or quite successful or whatever. They've just got to be really interesting people that we can get stuck into. You know, multifaceted lives like Jackie. Yeah, be cool.
There we go. Let us know. And we've not even spoken about the app today, but I'll just do a quick run through of some of the stuff that's been on there recently. The Intercooler app. It's a new kind of digital car magazine. The whole point is that we've got the best writers, the best writing, writing the most interesting stories, and it's all packaged in the most convenient way. And that's a digital app. It's on your phone. It's always with you. So recently, Andrew has driven, quite appropriately actually, the six-wheeled Tyrrell P34. We've had Andrew English having a good old rant about touchscreens and associated technology. That's resonated with a lot of people. We've also had a couple of pieces from Henry Catchpole. He's driven the new Bowler Defender and a McLaren F1. So there's been some really cool stuff.
Sorry for Henry this week.
No sympathy from us. But go and check out the app. Just search the Intercooler on whichever app store you use. You'll find it and you can start your free trial. Go on.
And we put up new stories, apart from Sunday, every single day. So it's not like you have to wait a month or 3 months or whatever for your monthly or quarterly mag to come out. New stories, top writers, every day.
Go and check out the app. That's all I want you to do this week, so thank you for listening.
Thanks. See you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.